Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural, and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
All right. Folks, thanks for coming along tonight for our third function of the year, where Sarah Goldman makes a welcome first appearance at the Sydney Institute on the occasion of the publication of her first book, Carolyn Chisholm, An Irresistible Force, How One Extraordinary Woman Helped Shape a Nation. Now, I'll introduce our speaker briefly. She spent most of her life as a journalist, initially working for newspapers in Sydney and London, and she later transferred to television with the BBC. And back in Australia, Sarah continued as a producer for both commercial and ABC television news in Sydney and in Melbourne. And she's worked variously for the ABC, for the BBC, for Channel 9, and for such newspapers, for News Limited newspapers in Australia, and for papers like the Daily Mail and the Evening Standard in London. But this is her first book, and we're very pleased to have Sarah Goldman here to talk on the topic, Carolyn Chisholm, A Game Changer in Early Australia. You're very welcome. Thank you.
Thank you, Jerry. It's terrific to be here at the Institute tonight. And good evening, everyone, and thank you for asking me to come to talk about Carolyn Chisholm. So, Carolyn Chisholm, who was she? Her name's been vaguely familiar to most of us. It's permeated our consciousness in a variety of ways. There's the federal electorate in Melbourne called Chisholm, the suburb of Canberra called Chisholm, there's a hill in the New South Wales Southern Highlands called Chisholm. There are schools, aged care homes, streets, parks, too numerous to mention. She was, of course, on our $5 note, and she was also on our 5-cent stamp. But for all of that, most of us don't really remember much about her. When I started writing this biography, a friend said to me, "Oh, Carolyn Chisholm, that's right. She was the headmistress at my daughter's school." Well, not unless the daughter was at school in the 1800s, so obviously not. But it was that lack of knowledge by my own sons that started me to investigate her. They knew nothing about her, and to be honest, I didn't know much more. But we learned so little about the few influential women from our history that I thought it was important that it was time that they did find out something about at least one of them. And the more I discovered Carolyn, the more she fascinated me. She has been my constant companion for about 6 years, so I've got to know her very well in that time. I researched the facts and evidence of her life, what she did, where she went, how she did it. But what really drove me, what was really interesting to me, was the flesh and blood woman behind the story. Who was she really? So, in an effort to understand her, I considered, amongst other things, what it was like for a 19th century woman to give birth, to lose a child, to be separated from her husband for years at a time, particularly in Sydney, when she was quite an attractive and very eligible young lawyer, Thomas Callaghan, made her the centre of his attention. And in view of the attacks on her of the feminists of the 1970s, I was curious about her understanding of a woman's role in society and how she managed the balance as a working mother herself. So through my research, I discovered a woman with a surprising modern approach to religion and ethnicity, a pragmatic, humane, and humorous woman with immense self-confidence. Sometimes sarcastic, not always tactful, she was nonetheless a political reformer who believed essentially in the rights of women and that quintessential Australian maxim the A Fair Go for All. Now, there's so much I could actually say about Caroline, but I've been given a time limit tonight. So I will focus on three major aspects. First being her very different attitude from other 19th century women. Her work with the poor immigrants, and probably the least known about her, her social radicalization, her radicalism, sorry, that I believe still resonates with us today. Now, most females of Caroline's era, unless you were the queen, of course, were restrained legally, financially, and socially. The husbands had right of control over their wives and their children, and all the goods and money earned or owned by the women. Females were considered inferior emotionally and intellectually. I wouldn't get away with that today. As one well-known author of the 1840s, Sarah Stickney Ellis, wrote in her book, Daughters of England, and I quote, "As women then, the first thing of importance is to be content to be inferior to men. Inferior in mental power in the same proportion that you are inferior in bodily strength." And this was from her chapter advising women on the preparation of marriage. So what I found so compelling about Caroline was she stood out as being on a different plane entirely. She didn't fight against those beliefs. She didn't try to shirt front anyone. She just ignored them with superb, overreaching confidence. On three continents, in India, in Britain, Australia, and in Britain, she sought out the powerful men, and she was able to bend them to her will to make the world a better place for the disadvantaged. Now, there were early signs that Caroline was not conventional. Although there are doubts about her legitimacy, Caroline was definitely the daughter of William Jones, an illiterate man who started life as an itinerant agricultural day worker, but ended a wealthy member of the nascent rural middle class. She was the youngest of his 16 children. Well, he had four wives, so that explains some of it. Born in Northampton, an unremarkable English Midlands town, she did what was expected of her. She married. But Caroline was very careful with her choice. When Archibald Chisholm, a lieutenant in the East India Company, fell in love with her and proposed, she told him that she wanted to lead a public life, an idea almost unheard of for women in the 1800s. Caroline explained that she wanted to work at helping the less fortunate. She insisted that Archibald stay away from her for a month and consider, because such a wife could be inconvenient for a soldier who wanted promotion in the East India Company. Archibald, 30 days later, returned, saying he accepted her terms. They were married just after Christmas in 1830. She was 22, he was 32. Their marriage was to last 46 years. In that time, Caroline would become one of the most recognized women across the British Empire. There were public triumphs and personal tragedies, including sickness, poverty, and death. Archibald was an ordinary man, an adequate soldier. He'd had a classical education, but he knew little about practical finances, always struggling to make ends meet. But in all the years together, he never once shied away from the promise that he gave her that day. Archibald supported Caroline unconditionally. Unusually for the time, theirs was not a marriage of man and wife, but it was a true partnership. The first year of marriage, though, brought tragedy. Caroline fell pregnant almost immediately, but her baby, also named Caroline, died within 3 weeks of being born. With one exception, previous biographers have ignored this baby. Infant mortality was not unusual in the 1800s. In fact, it's estimated that some 16% of children died within the first 2 years. So it's easy enough to give this a metaphorical shrug and ignore it. But how devastating it must have been for Caroline. Here was a young woman, a young devout woman, in love with her husband, and the child was not just another statistic, it was her daughter. Her baby's death helped Caroline find a purpose. She had always known that she wanted to help the underprivileged, but from this point she spent the rest of her life attempting to save other women's daughters, almost as though to make up for the loss of her own. She was trying to give the poor girls and young women some choice in life, apart from the drudgery or the prostitution that they needed just to survive. It would be almost 2 decades and 4 sons later before Caroline had another daughter. Not long after the child's death, Archibald returned to India. Caroline joined him there about 18 months later. Now, it was a wildly exotic location for a woman who had, until then, lived her life in a myopic rural seclusion. She was thrust into a brightly colourful world. It was not just the heat that would have been challenging. She was also confronted by snake charmers, half-naked local men, and the indolent life of the English Memsahib. However, Caroline was not the sort to sit back and gossip over tea and cake for hours. Near the start of her 5 years in India, she opened a vocational school for the needy daughters of the British foot soldiers in Madras, modern-day Chennai. In doing so, she convinced the governor of Madras, the Battle of Waterloo hero Sir Frederick Adam, to support this project. This gave her valuable experience in manipulating authority and important people and in her organisational abilities. And during those years, she also gave birth to 2 healthy boys. Now, I'm including this next little bit because I think it's important to have a think about what life for a woman was like in those days, particularly in India. And in a world where mathematicians had devised calculus, scientists the telescope, and engineers the steam engine, medicine in the first half of the 19th century, particularly when it referred to women, was still evolving very slowly, guided often as much by folklore and pseudoscience as genuine medical knowledge. British women in India were told not to suckle their own babies after the first few days because their constitution was far too delicate. And one well-respected English army doctor even published a book on raising children in India, devoting at least 2 chapters to this short-term breastfeeding. He suggested that if a woman suffered from lumps in her breast whilst breastfeeding, then the nurse should, quote, suck the breast dry with her own mouth. Then he suggested that it should be rubbed with oil and brandy. It gets better. And after which up to 2 dozen leeches should be applied to the lump. To make certain the treatment worked, the lump should be, quote, fermented with hot water so as to encourage the bleeding. To my mind, the cure must have been a lot worse than the actual condition. Anyhow, Caroline survived this and so did her 2 sons. By 1838, Caroline was 30 and Archibald was due another furlough. So the family headed to Sydney, initially settling at Windsor, and another child was born. A 3rd boy, Henry, whose descendant is actually here tonight. And Henry's descendants still contribute mightily to Sydney, the Sydney community, or to the Australian community. In fact, the world community, I think. But within 18 months of their arrival, Archibald was needed back in India to cover for officers being sent to China at the start of the Opium Wars. Caroline, with the 3 young children, decided to stay in Australia. Now, Sydney in 1840 was an uneasy mix of beauty, opportunity, and horror. Can you imagine what it would have been like sailing in the Heads on a bright spring morning? Almost no buildings the whole way down the harbour until Sydney Cove. It must have been beautiful. The town itself, however, received mixed reviews. There were reports of excellent shops in George Street, and this bit I like, and lovely little cottages with gardens in Pitt Street. Others were not so kind, describing Sydney as second class, dusty and dirty. What really mattered, though, was that the colony was on the verge of a humanitarian crisis. Transportation was ending, increasing the need for free workers. Thousands of poor bounty immigrants, their passages paid by the colonial government, were being brought into Sydney, many, many more than the town could actually absorb. In an effort to even up the gender numbers, a significant percentage were single girls with high hopes of doing well in this new world. Their arrival coincided with serious commercial slump in Sydney. There was not a stock market in town there, so they wouldn't have had the problems of today, but the not unfamiliar property speculation cycle of boom and bust had by then created a severe downturn. Britain was in recession, meaning lesser exports to the home country, and the whole was exacerbated by a drought that was to last for 6 years. It was a perfect storm. Of course, it was the girls that caught Caroline's attention. By 1841, it was estimated that some 600 were destitute in Sydney. There were few shelters, even fewer jobs. Caroline wanted to start a home for them. Ignored at first by the governor, Sir George Gipps, who, though describing her as an attractive young matron, considered that she had, quote, overrated the powers of her own mind. She nonetheless kept battling, supported by the press, but not by the clergy. One of the main obstacles she encountered was the religious division. Caroline had been born a Protestant, but when she married Archibald, a Catholic, she converted to his faith. There was considerable animosity between the two religions at this time. Her attitude to religion and also ethnicity was one of the major surprises that I encountered in my research. Although genuinely a true devotee of Catholicism, she believed that no creed should be preeminent. Saying in a letter to the colonial secretary, Lord Stanley, in 1842, and I quote, "I have no wish to see any power, whether English or Irish, Catholic or Protestant, have too much in their own hands, for one might try to oppress the others." Similarly, in response to the Protestant firebrand John Dunmore Lang in 1846, who attacked her for encouraging Catholic emigration, saying that he wanted to live and die amongst his own people, Caroline responded, "My idea, quote, my idea of good neighbourhood is not so contracted. I have lived happily amongst pagans and heathens, Mohammedans and Hindus. They have never molested me in my devotion, nor did I insult them in theirs." Later in London, she would assist single Jewish girls and families to emigrate to the colonies, while in 1847, she acknowledged the indigenous people of Australia as, quote, the original owners of the land. This, some 145 years before the High Court's Mabo decision. Then, in the 1850s and 60s, she was not only teaching English to the Chinese, but also standing up for them against awful discrimination, both in Victoria and New South Wales, saying in the Melbourne Argus newspaper in 1847, quote, "This immigration cannot be stopped. There will be no rest until man is recognised as man without distinction of colour or clime." In fact, Caroline was supporting our idea of multiculturalism decades and decades before the word was even invented. Back in 1841, Caroline eventually convinced the governor and the various churches to back her plan for the bounty girls. In what was a radical idea for the time, she then invited clergy of all faiths to come in and attend to the girls at the home. And a plaque now marks a spot on the northeastern corner of Bent and Phillips Street where the old wooden home once stood. It was there that Caroline effectively set up a not-for-profit accommodation and employment agency, financed by a few donations and by the employers who paid for the benefit of having workers sent to them in the bush. Before opening the business, though, Caroline did her homework. She discovered how many girls were required in various areas for what type of work and at what rate of pay and what sort of conditions. She then took to the rugged bush tracks to deliver the girls into safe, well-paid employment, travelling miles from Sydney, north to Armidale, west to Gundagai, and on the coastal steamers up to the Hunter and beyond. These trips would have taken weeks to accomplish. Sir Roger Thierry, a judge, parliamentarian, and friend of Caroline's, described in his 1863 book one of her journeys. He wrote, I quote, "I remember meeting her on the Goulburn Road as early as 5 o'clock in the morning, when the first burst of an Australian spring loads the air with the perfume of acacias and the glades of the open forest are clothed in a mantle of bright green. Mrs. Chisholm, herself wrapped in a loose cloak, was seated on the top of a dray, laden with casks and bales of goods. Besides her and around her were seated 12 or 14 young girls. Alongside of the dray walked about 30 others. Each girl was guaranteed good wages and conditions by a written contract. In fact, Caroline insisted on the contracts being written in triplicate, one for the employer, one for the employee, and one that she kept at the home. She wrote over 2,000 contracts. Not one of them was ever challenged in a court of law. Now, can you imagine what would be involved in setting up an organisation like that today, even putting aside the planning commissions? And yet this was accomplished by a woman on her own with the benefit of no more than a reasonable education, a very good sense of organisation, and sheer persistence. And it was set up at a time when gas lights were only just lighting the streets of Sydney, when universal franchise, even for men, was still a pipe dream, and the first train in the colony was still some 15 years into the future. It was not long before she expanded this enterprise to include families and single men. Where people remember Caroline, it is probably for these endeavours with the poor bounty girls particularly, and families. And indeed, it started off a chain reaction that led to the rest of her incredible life. But it is this work that caused the feminists of the 1970s to criticise her for being, I quote, "the ideological underpinning of more than a century of domestic servitude by Australian women." I have absolutely no doubt that they were wrong. Caroline certainly did put women into domestic and menial jobs, and she did encourage them to marry when appropriate. However, she was no white slaver prostituting girls out on exclusive long-term contracts. Caroline didn't see marriage as a lesser of two evils, but as a separate entity. Primarily, she understood that girls needed safe working environments. Now, where have we heard that one before? She was catering for thousands of ill-educated and illiterate women in little control of their own lives or the chance to improve it. There was no universities in Australia when she started her work, and in any case, women weren't admitted to tertiary institutions until the 1880s. What Caroline did was to establish the poor female immigrants from Britain in secure employment with proper wages and identifiable conditions well before there was even such a thing as unionism in Australia, even for men. Nor did she expect women to be little more than domestic drudges, telling an emigration meeting in the UK in 1853, quote, "I never can imagine that Almighty God sent females into the world to be cooks and housemaids all their days." And she realised that self-sufficient women were necessary for the colony if it was to progress. Writing in the Argus in Melbourne in 1855, "We ought not to forget that if this country is to become a great nation, we must endeavour to uphold in the females who come here principles of self-reliance and independence. In effect, Caroline was giving the women a choice and wherewithal to support themselves for as long as they needed to do so, offering them the respect and the opportunity to build substantially better lives than the ones they had left behind. In all, during her first 8 years here, she assisted between the women, the families, and the men, some 11,000 immigrants. Caroline also made ocean travel a lot safer for poor passengers, particularly women. In 1842, she initiated the first prosecution in Australia against a ship's captain and the ship's doctor. The men from the immigration boat, the Carthaginian, had bullied and brutalized a female passenger on the voyage to Sydney. After lobbying to have the two men charged, Caroline also gave evidence in court. Both men were found guilty. Both were sentenced to 6 months jail and a £50 fine. And in doing so, because it was in court, it became a new standard of behaviour, so that the passengers knew that they couldn't be brutalised anymore by the ship's captains. They had a say. But that wasn't the end of it, not by a long shot. When Archibald returned to Sydney, the family sailed to Britain. Caroline, then 38 years of age, gave birth to her fourth son on board the boat only days before landing in Hull. Despite the rigours of the birth, she launched almost immediately into what today would be called a family reunion plan, organising for left-behind wives and children of both convicts and early poor settlers to be sent to Australia. Not long after that, she also started up her Family Colonisation Loan Society. It's quite a mouthful, but basically it helped poor immigrants with their passage so they could travel to Australia. And at the same time, she helped establish minimum health and safety standards on boats on the Australian run. She was so very busy that one understandable criticism levelled at her was her attitude towards her own children. At one stage, even defying Archibald by taking her three oldest boys out of school because she could not afford the fees and to also continue her work with the immigrants. She realised that she was compromising the boys' futures, and although expressing regret in a letter to a friend, she did not alter her actions. Her last three children, all girls, were born in London. The seventh child, a daughter named Sarah, died within 6 months. But unlike the first baby, Caroline seemed to have little time then to mourn her. During her 8 years in Britain, she helped some 5,000 emigrants to Australia, meeting a raft of influential people along the way, including the colonial secretary Earl Grey, who was the son of the tea man, Pope Pius IX, when she visited Rome, and also Charles Dickens. By now, Caroline was featuring in newspapers across the British Isles, one of the best known women of her day. She turned journalist herself, and she wrote for one of Dickens' magazines. Now, although he was a fierce philanthropist, Dickens was highly disapproving of Caroline for not paying enough attention to her domestic duties, describing what he called her dirty children in a letter to a friend. He satirised her as Mrs. Jellyby in his novel Bleak House, written about 2 years after they first met. Unfairly, though, Dickens was comparing Caroline to wealthy and often single women like Florence Nightingale and Baroness Berta Coutts, the banking heiress, who had more than enough funds to pay somebody else to look after their households. As the years went on, Caroline's radical view of the world became more pronounced. Returning to Australia between 1854 and 1866, she lived at first in Melbourne, visiting the goldfields within weeks of the Eureka Stockade. In fact, the leader of the revolt, Peter Layler, had travelled to Victoria on one of the boats organised by Caroline's London Society. So I guess we could almost say that she was responsible for Eureka as well. Whilst in Melbourne, Caroline organised the construction and operation of a series of shelter sheds for poor diggers on their way to the Castlemaine goldfields. By the late 1850s, though, she was very unwell, and the Chisholm finances were dire. Most of the family returned to Sydney. But although she was sick, she had not finished yet. She wrote a novella, serialised in one of the Sydney papers, which talked about the nobility of the working man. And then she held a series of lectures, which, in fact, was an extraordinary thing for a woman to do. Even 10 years later in London, Mrs. Peter Taylor, chairperson of the first public suffragette meeting, was mocked as being not only ridiculous, but also immoral, because she ventured into public life. No such censure was levelled against Caroline. Caroline had already been called years earlier to publicly give evidence before select government committees on immigration, both in London and in Sydney. In each case, she was the lone woman amongst many men. Caroline's talks in Sydney were attended by hundreds of people and reported throughout the colony by the press. Amongst other progressive views, she wanted full democracy, including votes for women. In a time of high property prices, and some things never change, she wanted a freeing up of the land so the poorer people would be able to buy their own plot. She called for an 8-hour working day, and she even suggested that men should help with the housework. Radical indeed. Caroline was a remarkable woman, with humour, intellect and passion, and an incredible organisational ability. She was truly an irresistible force. Her achievements are still resonating in Australia today, and I suspect in the audience now there are some of you whose forebears had their original successful start in Australia, thanks to Caroline. I believe her spirit lives on in this country. Thank you.
So, many thanks to Sarah Goulburn. As I said earlier, this is talks taking place around the time of the publication of Caroline Chisholm, An Irresistible Force, How One Extraordinary Woman Helped Shape a Nation, and we've got copies of the book over there for after, and I'm sure the author would be happy to sign copies. Now we get on to questions and discussion. So before I lead off with a question, just finalise it. She dies, she's buried in her hometown, right?
In Northampton, yes.
In Northampton, and the grave's visible?
Yes.
Okay.
The grave is visible.
The grave's visible. Right, now, thanks for that. It was a very, very interesting account of Caroline Chisholm. Now, I guess the feminist who criticised her, say, 40 years ago is probably Anne Summers in Damn Whores and God's Police. Now, she wouldn't call Ms. or Mrs. Chisholm a damn whore, but she obviously thinks she was one of God's police. But can I just get you to reflect on that? Because Anne Summers herself, as I understand it, was educated in the Catholic schools by nuns who gave up their life for her education. So it's a pretty harsh judgment. And, of course, there's about 150 years between Caroline Chisholm's birth and Anne Summers' birth, so it's well over a century. So to what extent do you think that Anne Summers, around 1970, is making a judgment of what happened, say, more than 100 years ago, around 100 years ago and beyond, from a perspective that no one really ever thought about at the time? In other words, how fair is that kind of assessment judged in contemporary terms?
Right, well, I suppose the quick short answer would be that someone could criticise me because I am making an assumption or making suggestions even further away than when Anne did. And yes, the quote is from Anne's book, and I actually deal with that in my book. The quote about damn whores and God's police, the term God's police actually was written by Caroline. And she did say that what the colony did need, more than more than churches, more than school teachers, what they actually needed were women and children, and she described them as God's police. And I think when Anne, and I would not try to second guess Anne's motivation for that. The 70s was a time when obviously there was a necessary need to break forward with the women's movement. But Caroline was, what she was actually doing was what governments of all complexions tend to do. They were trying to cherry pick the sort of immigrants they wanted to come here. And to Caroline's mind, women who were not of good reputation, to use her terms, would not have found it easy to find jobs here and would not be wanted for wives here and partners. And there was a need in the colony because there were so few women that they needed women for both. So she was basically saying, what we need in this colony are women who will make wives and will also make good, steady workers. She also, the other criticism was that only women, the other criticism by Anne Summers, and I have immense admiration for Anne, so I don't really want to turn this into a she said sort of thing. But the other thing she said is that the suggestion was that only women had the civilizing agent and that men weren't civilized, and why couldn't we believe that men were civilized? Caroline actually said that she had, and she did, she traveled throughout the colony of New South Wales and saw all sorts of men in all sorts of conditions. And she said that she was amazed and she was delighted to find, and I'm paraphrasing her words here, that even the men, the convicts who had gone through some of the hell holes of Norfolk Island and such like, many of them turned out to be good, upstanding citizens. She was basically saying that she could attest that these men were upright men, even if they had been convicts and been through bad times. So she wasn't saying women were necessary only on that basis. What she was saying is that you need the right sort of people to be wives and workers, and that, unfortunately, prostitutes were not going to cut that deal.
Yeah. At the same time, it's interesting, there was another figure in Australia who was cherry-picking immigrants and very strong and powerful, forceful, and that was John Dunmore Lang. And they did know one another. He was also a Bible and Catholic. Can you give us a bit of the story of how different they were, how they were supportive of each other at certain points and yet very much on a different wavelength than what they did for the colony individually?
It's a fascinating relationship between Caroline and John Dunmore Lang, who was a Presbyterian minister. And again, he was a name that I'd heard of, but until I did my research into this book, I didn't know nearly as much as I do now about him. Now, the two of them seem to have had a bit of a love-hate relationship. There was the quote that I mentioned in here. He was against Caroline because he thought that she would proselytize for the Catholics and she would only bring in Catholic immigrants. And he wanted a Protestant society. She continually worked against that, and everything she said and did showed that she was not only selecting Catholic girls, she went right across the board with everyone. He, on occasions, acknowledged that, and he actually said, she's good, but I'm scared that the church leaders will sway her and she won't know what she's doing, and therefore she'll be a tool of theirs. And the relationship went on and off. When they were both on committees together and they actually talked to each other on these committees and were often on the same side of the immigrants, John Dunmore Lang also contributed to her. They gave her a present when she left Australia, and he was one of the first to contribute, and he contributed the maximum amount he was allowed to do so, because he did respect her. Then again, in England, he wrote a letter to the papers there criticising her again and saying that the colonial secretary, Earl Grey, at the time, was attached to her apron strings and doing what she wanted. So it went backwards and forwards. The very last report I have of them together is at one of the meetings, one of the lectures that I spoke about it near the end. It was one of the four lectures between 1859 and 60, 61. And he actually turned up. And in the end, at the end of the lecture, there were three. The whole audience gave three cheers to both of them. So in a way, it was a handshake across a divide between the religious. Both of them tried to do the best they could. They just came at it from different angles.
Sarah, thank you for your book. I enjoyed it immensely. It was given to me by one of my students. I'm principal of Caroline Chisholm College
okay.
in Sydney, near Penrith. I'm wondering if you could imagine how your book might inspire the very modern teenage women of Western Sydney.
Well, I suppose a lot of what I was writing, I actually had young women in mind, as you can probably tell. And I think what is important are a number of things. One is that, as I said near the beginning, our history, we have very few women, and she is definitely one that we should admire and we should look at. Secondly, I think also the fact that she stood up and she behaved differently because she could. There was no reason. She had a good education, and maybe that's something as a principal you should, or a headmaster you should be saying to your students, that her education was one of the most important things that took her along her journey. But she was not scared to be different and to stand up for what she believed and just to give it a go. And I think it's important for women to know that where they've come from is basically where they're going to. They have to stand up, and you have to have respect for women.
Question here.
Is this on there?
Press it up.
Anne told not to turn it on.
No, press it up.
Push it up.
Press it up. Push it up.
I'm doing that.
Sorry.
You said don't turn it on.
Until you speak.
What did you say?
Okay, let's go. Okay.
Well, no kidding. Well, I'm sure I speak for everybody when I say that was a very interesting and well-presented talk, which very inspiring. But what I didn't understand is, why did she become this way? How did she take a line that was 100 years at least ahead of her environment? What caused her to have these thoughts?
You've almost stumped me, not quite. She had an unusually good education, which was more by luck than by chance. More by luck than by anything deliberate. And I think she was an extremely intelligent, she was a very clever woman. Her daughter describes her as being able to do numerous things. She spoke French at least. She knew scientific things. She had an incredibly inquisitive mind. I think she was just one of those outriders who was an intelligent woman with a reasonably good education who just wanted to do something in the world and was able to do so. It's her father died before she was seven. She was sent away to live with a lady who could have been her natural mother, but we don't know. She went off to boarding school. She was a woman who, as I said, she was an outrider, just somebody, we have them in this world that stand up and are extraordinary people, and she was one.
So what sort of boarding school? Would that have been a Church of England boarding school? Or?
We don't know that. In Northampton, where she grew up, there were a number of ladies' schools, and the education for 19th century women was not particularly good. But occasionally, you came across a good one.
Up the back.
You just about answered my question about the schooling, but how does the daughter of an itinerant agricultural worker, uneducated, get such a good education? Where did the money come from?
Okay.
You said she was legitimate, but was she really illegitimate?
She was possibly illegitimate, and
So it was her natural mother who paid?
No, not at all. Her father, William Jones, was a remarkable guy, and if anything, I suspect it was his genes that pushed her. To answer your question, William Jones started as an itinerant day worker. Bit by bit, he worked his way up. He married 4 times, 16 children, as I said. He went from being an itinerant day worker. He then went into the shoe business. Shoe business was very big. They were making shoes in Northampton. He did some of that. He worked in an inn for a while, bit by bit. He became a hog jobber, i.e. he bought and sold and raised pigs. And he amassed an incredible fortune. When he died, he was still illiterate when he died because it was his mark, not his name on his will. But he was able to leave his wife immediately, just so she'd be all right, an equivalent of something like £500, which in 1814, which is the year he died, was akin to, it's in the book somewhere, but it's in, you know, a lot of money. We're talking, you know, 500,000 or more. It was a lot of money. What happened, and one of the reasons that we talk about her possibly being illegitimate, I'll get that tissue in a second, is that in his will, he left a certain amount to his wife to leave and to look after the children and to his other older children and various other bequests. But to Caroline, the youngest, and also her older brother, he left different bequests. And in Caroline's case, he left a property in Bearwood Street in Northampton, which is no longer there. And it actually, her stepbrother was actually farming that property at the time. So there's, it appears that she sold that property, and the money from that may well have helped towards her education. And none of her siblings, either her full siblings or her half siblings or any other of William Jones's children, received the sort of education that she did. They all received an education, but it was far inferior. If that helps, if that answers that.
Well, look, dear lady, I note your angle on what she did and achieved at that particular time, 150 years ago or so. Do you ever feel that that particular angle that you have accentuated sometimes is not pushed through enough in the current teaching of history in Australian schools, i.e. the fact that people like Caroline achieved so much, but crikey, the fact that it was done 150 years ago adds immeasurably to her achievement. Is that not accentuated enough in current teaching of history in the Australian curriculum?
I'm not an expert on Australian curriculum, but it was something that certainly I found interesting, because I know what it's like. We all die if we don't have air conditioning today, and yet, you know, all of our forebears in this country, I think, are remarkable for what they achieved and how they achieved it, given the conditions.
So tell us why did you write the book? I mean, you made the point earlier on, I think the last book on Caroline Chisholm is probably almost half a century ago, but there was some material, not so?
No. There was one.
Mary Hoban's 1970, isn't it?
Yes, but
well,
there was...
close to half a century ago.
Carol Walker. 10 years ago.
Carol Walker was the other one.
2008.
All right, so one's half a century ago, one's 10 years ago. Yeah. So why did you decide to do it?
Because what interested me was not just, as I said, where she went, what she did and how she did it, but who she was. And there have been some excellent books, and in fact, Mary Hoban's daughter rang me, which was an interesting conversation. She liked the book, which was good. I was trying to drill down more into what it was like to be a woman in those circumstances, and more than just what she did, which was amazing, how she did it, and etc., but who she was as a person. I mean, these days we all like to know motivation, we all like to know the personality, the feeling behind it, and that's what interested me. And I guess that's why I wrote the book, because I wanted to find out who she was.
I think that's a very good place to close on, so thank you very much. I'll just put this in my pocket. So I think here, as you mentioned earlier, we're very close to what for a large part of her life, or a significant part of life, was Carolyn Chisholm territory near the corner of Phillip Street and Bent Street. But thanks for, as you pointed on earlier, a lot of us know a little bit about Carolyn Chisholm, or certainly a group of us know a little bit about Carolyn Chisholm, but I probably thought more about her achievements, significant as they were, and probably less about who she was and how she did achieve what she did achieve. So I think what you've done tonight and in your book is put a bit of the personality into the history, which is a fine thing to do, and looked at it from a modern point of view. And certainly I think at this time today, she probably looks a bit different than what she did 50 years ago. As 50 years ago, she looked different than what she did 50 years before that. And you've covered all that today. So congratulations on tonight. As we said, copies of your books are available. I'm sure you'll write another one. But until then, well done, and thank you. And good luck.